Have a great day.
Today is Wednesday, May 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Denmark has decided not to use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, citing blood clot concerns. But how great of a risk does that pose?
The chances of getting this complication, these blood clots with low platelets, is only about 7 per 1 million women vaccinated.
Plus, the group of seven foreign ministers kicked off 2 days of meetings in London Tuesday. We'll have these stories and more next. Denmark has become the first country to exclude Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 shots from its vaccination program over a potential link to a rare but serious form of blood clot. The move comes after the Nordic country last month stopped using AstraZeneca's vaccine altogether, citing similar concerns. The country's health authority said in a statement it had found that the, quote, benefits of using the COVID-19 vaccine from Johnson & Johnson do not outweigh the risk of causing the possible adverse effect in those who receive the vaccine, end quote. I wanted to learn more, so I called up reporter Antonia Giannacaro in Copenhagen.
At the moment, there is a discussion at the government where they are deciding if they want to give these vaccines for free to people that ask for them.
Speaking of asking for vaccines, is anyone worried about an increase in vaccine hesitancy after the banning of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as well as the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Not really. I think everybody in Denmark is very positive about the outcome of the situation. We never had really shocking results. So we're just waiting about it. The only comments that I heard, they're concerned, why did we buy such a product without testing it before? So it's more like, yeah, what do we spend our money like that?
Overall, it doesn't sound like the removal of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine from the program is going to have a major impact.
But that's the point. They think they're going to be like delayed for 4 weeks. But also we have to think that Denmark only has a population of 5 million people. So, and we already have both 20 minus 8. We already have 12 million vaccines on 5 million people population. So we have doubled the amount that we actually need in the country.
Antonia Giannacaro spoke to me from Copenhagen, Denmark. While the Danish Health Authority has decided to stop using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the European Medicines Agency backed its overall benefits against any risks. However, it did stipulate that a warning about unusual blood clots with low platelets must be added to the vaccine's labels. Now, to better understand the risks, I had Paolo Verardi, Associate Professor of Virology and Vaccinology at the University of Connecticut, explain them.
So here in the U.S., the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, they still recommend the use of the Johnson & Johnson or Janssen vaccine, even after the temporary pause that we saw last month that was specific here in the U.S. And that pause was because of the rare risk of thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome. So essentially, it's a combination of blood clots with low platelet counts. And their position is that the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the potential risks for this condition. So their directive says that women 50 and younger should be aware of the potential risk and should also know of alternative vaccine options if available. And here, in the case of the U.S., the other two options will be the messenger RNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna. And what they are saying is that people in that women in that age group, 18 to 50, they should look out for symptoms up to 3 weeks after vaccination, after receiving the J&J vaccine. And those symptoms to look for are persistent headaches, if you have blurred vision, shortness of breath, chest pain, leg swelling, abdominal pain, if you're bruising easily, if you have, you know, blood spots or something under your skin. So if you see any of those things, you should get medical attention immediately. And I know that some of those things sound really scary. The whole thing sounds scary. But you need to remember that the chances of getting this complication, these blood clots with low platelets, is only about 7 per 1 million women vaccinated, and that's for that age group, you know, 18 to 50 years of age. So if you are a woman in that age group, you only have seven chances in 1 million of getting this complication. So even if you were to get it, you should know that, you know, we now know that there is a better way to treat it, and that we should not be using heparin-based blood thinners. We should be using other types of anticoagulants, something that we didn't know until last month. So the bottom line is that for women 18 to 50, they should look out for symptoms for 3 weeks after vaccination, and if available, they should consider alternative vaccines.
So overall, the chances of experiencing these complications is extremely rare, and we have better ways to treat it. So what does this mean in general terms moving forward for our global response to vaccination to reach herd immunity?
You know, we have this worldwide puzzle that we are trying to solve. And the J&J and some of the other adenovirus-based vaccines, the AstraZeneca being another example, they play a very important role. So people in some countries don't have the luxury of choosing or waiting for a specific type of vaccines. Just look at the situation now in Brazil, in India at the moment. Some people there want to get the vaccine, but they just don't have access to any vaccine. And the J&J and the AstraZeneca vaccines, they have some advantages. They are generally cheaper. They are generally to produce. They are generally more thermostable. So they are going to help us to finish the puzzle sort of piece by piece so that we can reduce the number of those empty spaces in the puzzle. Those will be the unvaccinated people that the virus can infect, can reproduce, and then spread. So what we're trying to do is to finish that puzzle and have it as complete as possible, as fast as possible. And we also want to do that in an equitable way. So the J&J, the AstraZeneca vaccines, we need them. They're going to help us to solve that puzzle, and they're going to help us to stop and at least slow down COVID-19 in the middle to long term.
University of Connecticut Associate Professor of Virology and Vaccinology, Paolo Verardi. Meanwhile, India has opened up its immunization drive to all adults as it reels under a catastrophic second wave of the novel coronavirus pandemic. But a shortage of vaccines in the country often called a vaccine powerhouse means inoculating a significant part of the 1.4 billion population. And that is still a distant goal. Anjana Pasricha takes it from here.
This is the most coveted jab in India as it reels under a ferocious second wave of the novel coronavirus pandemic. But although the inoculation drive for COVID-19 has been expanded to all above 18 years of age, vaccine shortages are hobbling the program.
The situation is extremely grim. I mean, of course, there aren't any words that can explain. The situation is extremely, extremely grim. The system is at a brink of collapse, and that's the reason why we try to get vaccinated as early as possible.
But some states say they cannot cover the 18-plus age group. They are even turning away older people as vaccine stockpiles fall short of demand. India, the world's largest vaccine producer, was relying on domestically produced doses. But the approximately 70 million shots being produced a month cannot cater to its massive needs.
And if you take the 18 to 44 age group, who are the new entrants into the program, we are talking about 595 million people. So we are talking about 1.2 billion doses, right? Because everybody requires two doses of the vaccine. So, in a sense, it's a huge ask. and our vaccine stocks currently do not measure up anywhere near that.
The government has stepped up efforts to get vaccines from overseas. Sputnik V doses arrived from Russia this week. Efforts are also on to accelerate domestic manufacturing, but it could take months to plug the shortfalls. Experts say India failed to stockpile enough vaccines as it prematurely declared victory against the pandemic during a lull in infections. It sent about 65 million doses to other countries as part of a vaccine diplomacy push.
I think it was sort of factored in their minds that we will not have to deal with the second wave, and therefore we could have a fairly measured, steady, graduated vaccination program which can flow in steps. And that is why we even felt we had the luxury of sending vaccines abroad to about 80 countries.
The sluggish rollout meant the country was largely unprotected when the second wave struck. About 2% of the population has been fully inoculated, while around 10% have received one dose. Now, fear overhangs the worst-hit cities like New Delhi, where hospitals and crematoriums are overwhelmed.
I deleted the social media apps for about a week in the middle because I just couldn't take it. You know, every time you open Twitter and everything, it's full of that. But then I had to get back because I realized that a lot of people are, you know, seeking help on that platform. And if I could be of any help, then I need to be available. So it's very anxious. I mean, the times are very anxious.
That anxiety will remain in a country waging an ongoing battle for hospital beds, drugs and oxygen. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. As the United States and its allies officially start withdrawing forces from Afghanistan, fears of increased violence and a Taliban return to power are making many Afghans anxious. VOA's Aisha Tanzim is up next.
Just another day for Noor Ahmad in Kabul. He deep fries samosas, a local favorite, hoping to sell them for iftar, the breaking of fast during Ramadan. He does not care whether the foreign forces stay or go.
The withdrawal will not impact our daily lives. No Americans or foreigners buy my food. Only Afghans buy it. So far, everything is going on as usual.
The United States and its allies have officially started withdrawing forces from Afghanistan and handing over operations to their Afghan counterparts. Some, like Ahmad, are indifferent. But the move to withdraw forces has sent shockwaves through large segments of society. Mehbooba is one of many young women who have seen a sea change in their lives without the Taliban.
Right now, all Afghan women are concerned, really concerned. We wish the international community would do something about protecting us. We fear things will go back to the past.
The past is when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan and women had few rights. Since then, the country has made huge strides. The new Afghanistan is marked with an explosion of media and entertainment options and an abundance of college-educated young people and working women. The international community has promised to stay engaged with the country after foreign forces are out. But Taliban have increased their attacks on the government and Afghan security forces in the past year, and peace negotiations between Taliban and the Afghan government have stalled. Confidence in the Afghan security forces and their ability to hold back the Taliban is low. Many, including senior U.S. officials, fear fighting will intensify and make cities vulnerable to a Taliban takeover. The government is trying to ease concerns. Last week, it gave media outlets a tour of the Special Operations Forces base, complete with guns blazing and tanks firing. General Hebatullah Alizadeh heads the Afghan Special Forces.
We expect the same thing, fighting, the intense fighting, but we are ready for that. It's our country. We will fight till the end, and we will eliminate these terrorists from Afghanistan.
Tough words that many, particularly young people, say provide little comfort. Many say even a negotiated political settlement with the Taliban will likely lead to a rollback of rights gained over two decades. In the worst case, they fear a return to the 1990s, when a bloody, multi-year civil war led to a Taliban military takeover of Kabul. As people go about their daily lives, walking around the streets, shopping for Eid, the apparent normalcy hides the nervousness of a nation anxious about its future. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
After coming to a halt 5 months ago, the U.S. mediated negotiations between Lebanon and Israel over a disputed maritime border resumed on Tuesday morning. Reporter George Aid explains, the delegation sat for over 5 hours at U.N. peacekeeper headquarters in Nakoura, South Lebanon.
U.S. diplomat John Disruptor arrived in Lebanon Monday evening to broker the talks. The U.S. State Department described the resumption of the discussions between the two countries that are technically still at war as a positive step towards a long-awaited resolution. Previous discussions stopped in December 2020 when Lebanon demanded a larger area of 860 square kilometers. Israel dismissed the Lebanese claim, stating it was not legal. The Lebanese presidency issued a statement announcing that the members of the Lebanese delegation met with Lebanese President Michel Aoun and briefed him on the deliberation that took place, pointing out that the head of the American delegation had requested that the negotiations be limited only between the Israeli and Lebanese border lines that are registered with the United Nations. Accordingly, President Aoun instructed the delegation not to pursue negotiations linked to preconditions, but rather to follow international law to reach a fair and equitable solution. A source from the Lebanese government told VOA that the talks have picked up from where it stopped a few months ago, however, with a different approach this time. George Aid for VOA News, Beirut, Lebanon.
Foreign ministers of the G7 group of industrialized nations are meeting in London this week, with climate change, Russia, and China among the topics up for discussion. Henry Ridgewell wraps up their first day of meetings.
Face to face for the first time in 2 years, G7 foreign ministers remained socially distanced as they met in London Tuesday. There is a full agenda for the two-day summit, including the G7's relations with Russia, which was ejected from the group after its forceful annexation of Crimea in 2014. G7 ministers condemned Moscow's recent deployment of troops on Ukraine's border. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
If Russia chooses to act recklessly or aggressively, we'll respond. But we're not looking to escalate. We would prefer to have a more stable, more predictable relationship. And
China is also high on the agenda. Again, Antony Blinken.
It is not our purpose to try to contain China or to hold China down. What we are trying to do is to uphold the international rules-based order.
Chinese state media accused the United States Tuesday of, in its words, deliberately hyping up the so-called China threat. The G7 is upholding the principles enshrined at its foundation in 1975, says analyst John Curtin of the G7 Research Group at the University of Toronto.
To protect within its own members and promote globally the values of open democracy and individual liberty. They were very much threatened by an expanding Russia above all in 1975, and they're still threatened by Russia today, but also China and other authoritarian regimes.
Britain also invited foreign ministers from Australia, India, South Africa, and South Korea to the talks, a demonstration of London's focus on the Indo-Pacific region. Again, John Curtin.
So what we are seeing is the birth of a broader democratic family, and if they're willing to put their country's name on paper alongside the democratic seven, the G7 itself, that will be an even more powerful signal.
G7 foreign ministers also discussed a coordinated response to the military coup in Myanmar and the violent crackdown on pro-democracy protests, and the US and NATO pullout from Afghanistan, which began this month. Dominic Raab is Britain's foreign secretary.
Making sure that we preserve the ability to deal with counterterrorism, that the gains that were hard won in Afghanistan are not lost, and also ultimately promoting dialogue and a peace process that benefits all Afghans.
Meanwhile, campaigners are calling on the G7 to ensure that poorer countries get access to coronavirus vaccines. The United Nations says close to 90% of all vaccines administered worldwide have gone to richer nations. The response to the pandemic will be a focus when Britain hosts the G7 Leaders Summit in June, set to be Joe Biden's first overseas visit as US president. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Myanmar's ambassador to the United Nations told the U.S. Congress Tuesday that Washington should target the state-run Myanmar oil and gas company and a state-owned bank with sanctions.
I wish to stress that Myanmar is not just witnessing another major setback to democracy, but also the crisis is threatening the regional peace and security. In line with the principle that a state has the responsibility to protect its own people from crimes against humanity, the NUG, together with the people, have taken all possible ways and means to defend our own people from the military's inhumane and brutal acts.
Ambassador Jamo Tun is a representative of elected lawmakers who oppose Myanmar's military junta. Some pro-democracy activists have also traveled to Myanmar's mountainous borderlands to join armed groups fighting for ethnic autonomy, raising fears of a spiraling conflict. Myanmar's junta-controlled media also announced a ban on satellite television receivers on Tuesday. The military leader said outside broadcasts threatened national security and threatened to jail anyone caught violating the measure. With mobile internet access largely cut off in a bid to quell anti-junta protests since the February 1st coup, Myanmar has increasingly appeared headed back to the state of isolation that preceded a decade of democratic reforms. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Advocacy Group says 760 civilians have been killed by security forces since the coup, but the junta disputes that figure and says 24 police and soldiers have died in the protest. Myanmar media also reported that 5 people were killed by at least one parcel bomb on Tuesday, including an ousted lawmaker and 3 police officers who had joined a civil disobedience movement opposing military rule. Mexico says that it will find out who was responsible for an overpass collapse that killed at least 24 people and injured dozens more when a train on Mexico City's newest metro line plunged onto a busy road below. Reuters reporter Chris Dignam has the details.
Workers in Mexico City slowly hoisted one of 2 train cars dangling above the site of a collapsed railway overpass on Tuesday, using several tall cranes to clear the twisted metal that plunged onto a busy road below Monday night, killing at least 24 people and injuring 79, including children.
El pueblo de México tiene que conocer toda la verdad.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador vowed that the government would find out who was responsible for the collapse of Mexico City's newest metro line. The crash has raised questions about safety on one of the world's busiest metro systems, which serves an area that is home to more than 20 million people. 4 people who live in the area told Reuters they observed the beams below the elevated tracks visibly shaking when trains crossed. The overpass was part of a railway line that was added to the network less than a decade ago and has been plagued by allegations of corruption. In 2014, just 2 years after it opened, several of the line's stations were closed for repairs of structural problems. The railway line was built by a consortium, including a company controlled by the family of Mexican tycoon Carlos Slim and the Mexican unit of French train maker Alstom. which said on Tuesday that it would cooperate with and assist Mexican authorities in the investigation.
Chris Dignam of Reuters News. Sources told a French news agency that Islamist militants have killed 35 people, including 5 troops and 15 militiamen, in 2 attacks in Nigeria's troubled northern Borno state. Since 2019, the army has mostly withdrawn from villages and smaller bases into so-called super camps. These are being described as fortified garrisons meant to give better protection against those attacks. Critics say the strategy has left militants with the freedom to roam rural areas unchallenged and made the highways vulnerable to kidnappings and assaults. In addition, Nigeria's armed forces have dismissed suggestions they should take over from President Muhammadu Buhari, who is facing mounting pressure over the country's worsening insecurity. It was not the first time Nigeria's armed forces have issued a statement backing Buhari, but the latest has come after weeks of criticism of the 78-year-old former general's failures to stem the protracted security crisis. A Holocaust survivor who testified at Nazi Commander Adolf Eichmann's trial has passed away. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Joseph Zalman Kleinman, a Holocaust survivor who testified against Adolf Eichmann at the Nazi commander's trial, died Tuesday, according to Israeli media. He was 91. Kleinman was one of fewer than 180,000 Holocaust survivors remaining in Israel. Born in Slovakia in January 1930, Kleinman and his family were deported by Nazi Germany to the camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau in 1944. His father, mother, and sister were killed at Auschwitz. After the war, Kleinman emigrated to Israel. Eichmann, one of the architects of the Holocaust, was captured by Israeli Mossad agents in Argentina in 1960. Put on trial in Jerusalem in 1961, Eichmann was found guilty of crimes against humanity, crimes against the Jewish people, and war crimes, and executed the following year. I'm Mike Gracia.
And finally, a new song and music video by a singer from northern Ghana is shaking up the region with positive energy. Heather Maxwell, the host of Music Time in Africa, explains.
Sharifa Gunu is up here again.
After 4 years of putting her music career on hold for her family, Sharifa Gunu from Tamale, Ghana has bounced back with a brand new album and a new hit single. It's entitled Dopeda. This song, that also features reggae dancehall artist Ras Kuku, has been racking up thousands of YouTube views and AudioMax streams by northern Ghanaians since March. The music and the hook are catchy, that's for sure. But the real juice is in the message. What is true love?
Your love is all I need. Yeah, bigger, you be the one I need.
Well, Sharifa sat down earlier this week from her studio in Tamale, Ghana, to tell it to us straight.
Topic of Dopeda. In the centuries till today, we have folk songs and the stories they used to tell and the things they used to say. Dopeda, omamu wagar daza. And that's a verse. And those things mean man has entered market. His lover is the tallest one among the people. Because so far as the person is your lover, no matter how the people are crowded, you definitely see the person in the midst of the people. Because of what? The love between you and the person become a spiritual joint. When women gather plenty, whatever, she will be the first person for you to hear the voice. Because you people are connected. So we should respect relationships. So love is not a partiality. Love is a spiritual joint.
So that was Sherifa Gunu from Tamale, Ghana, with her comeback single, Dopeda. Love is a spiritual thing.
And that'll do it for us. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events by porting your web browser 24 hours a day to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.